You have entered the realm of the Witch Files, where imagination meets mystery,
creativity meets action,
and culture meets magic.
Journey with us as we discover the metaphysics
found between the pages, within the flash of an image, and through the rhythm of sound.
Open your hearts and minds and experience where thought forms become manifest. Symbols connect to blood memories,
and transformation is inevitable. This is
The Witch Files.
Greetings, I'm Sabrina.
And I'm Karen.
And we welcome you to this episode of The Witch Files, a podcast that reviews popular media featuring themes involving the occult in all its incarnations. But before we begin, beware, this show will contain spoilers.
Greetings to all you lovely seekers out there, and welcome to episode 27 of The Witch Files. Today we are very excited to review the first half of season 1 of the 2018 Netflix series, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. The series is based on the 2014 Sabrina horror comic by the same name, written by Roberto Aguirre Sacasa. Mr. Aguirre Sacasa is the chief creative officer of Archie Comics and serves as executive producer and showrunner for both Sabrina and Riverdale. The second half of season 1 of Sabrina will premiere on Netflix on April 5th.
The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina follows the teen half-witch, half-mortal Sabrina Spellman as she walks the edge between the mortal realm she grew up in and the Church of Night, her family's satanic coven. Forced to choose, Sabrina bravely forges her own way to stay ahead of the wiles of the Dark Lord and uses her craft against the forces that threaten her and her loved ones. With the flavor of the best classic horror films and a 60s aesthetic, The Chilling Adventures is the horror reboot we've been hungry for.
The show is rich with a wealth of witches and humans with varying magical abilities, and we would like to kick off the review with a brief description of the most prominent characters. Let's begin with the witches of Greendale. The witches are long-lived and appear to age very slowly, which is connected to the enhanced magical powers conferred on them by their pact with the devil. They are also a very sexy, fashionable bunch, and I've since seen street style inspired by these witches. First up is the teenage witch, Sabrina Spellman.
Sabrina Spellman, played by Kiernan Shipka, is our rebellious, brave, clever, and caring teen witch protagonist. Raised by her aunts, Sabrina is the orphan of Edward Spellman, former Church of Night patriarch, and her Catholic mortal mother, Diana Spellman. She's faced with choosing between two worlds, her witch birthright in the path of night, or to remain mortal, but Sabrina finds her own way in this dark world. Her dual status is taboo, but the high rank of her deceased father and the keen interest of Satan himself keeps her from being ostracized by the coven. Raised as a mortal, but homeschooled in the craft, Sabrina's inexperience is made up for with ingenuity and raw power. Sabrina manages most basic spells with ease, but also powers through the dangerous advanced practices of necromancy, exorcism, and banishing. She could possibly become the most powerful witch of the age, but is also willful and reckless with her magic, needing to repeatedly be bailed out of trouble by her family. Though Sabrina sometimes causes more problems with her attempts to help, she is a devoted friend who uses her magic to aid her buddies, to challenge the status quo, and fight the injustices they encounter.
Zelda Fiona Spellman, played by Miranda Otto, is Sabrina's paternal aunt. She, along with her sister Hilda, have raised Sabrina since she was a newborn baby. Zelda is a powerful witch who is a firm believer in the Church of Night and the spiritual and cultural rules and roles of their witch society. She is the unofficial head of the Spellman family, who leads with delicious snark and a glamorous gothic attitude. She is domineering and bossy, which often puts her at odds with the members of her family. She has a codependent and sometimes psychologically abusive relationship with her younger sister Hilda, reminiscent of Cain and Abel. Despite her incessant bluster, Zelda deeply loves her family and will do anything to protect them. She runs a mortuary business with Hilda and serves as a midwife in their witch community. Zelda has shown herself to be an expert at magically dealing with demons and other malignant spirits. She also is adept at astral travel, warding, telekinesis, exorcism, and weather magic. The energetic feel of her power is very high magic, as opposed to the earthier magic of her sister. But her midwife profession also anchors her firmly in the folk archetype of the witch.
Hildegard Antoinette Spellman, played by Lucy Davis, is Sabrina's second paternal aunt. Hilda is the sweet, motherly, and free-spirited witch of the Spellman family. She's funny, quirky, empathetic, and practical. Underneath the sweetness and seemingly lack of confidence lies a strong will and rebellious nature. She can be fiercely protective of her loved ones and quite vengeful when crossed. She's not a fan of the Church of Night and was excommunicated by the church for accompanying her sister-in-law, Diana, to Sabrina's secret baptism at a local Christian church. Hilda is an expert herbalist, potion maker, and healer. She is also adept at folk magic, exorcism, divination, astral travel, and weather magic. She seems to be well-versed in the folklore of the witch world. Hilda works at the Spellman Mortuary and at Cerebus Books. Of the two aunts, she is the one that Sabrina feels most comfortable with, and the one she seeks out for advice.
Ambrose Spellman, played by Chance Perdomo, is Sabrina's gay paternal cousin. He has been under house arrest for the last 75 years, forbidden to leave the grounds as punishment for attempting to blow up the Vatican. He refused to name his co-conspirators at the time, but did admit later that he had been under the influence of none other than Aleister Crowley. He is very isolated and lonely, and feels great guilt over his past transgression. In appearance, Ambrose is a young man of color, but is clearly older than he looks. He has a mischievous spirit and a laid-back classic rock and roll cool attitude. Like his Aunt Zelda, Ambrose is adept at demonology, warding, and astral travel. He's also adept at necromancy, which is considered one of the dark and forbidden arts. He also works at Spellman Mortuary as a mortician.
Madame Satan, played expertly by Michelle Gomez, is a powerful witch and demon who rose from the dead and stole the body of a mortal schoolteacher, Mary Wardwell, named for Samuel Wardwell, executed during the Salem witch trials. She is a literal devourer of men and the mother of demons, connecting her to the biblical Lilith. She tells Sabrina she was excommunicated from her own coven, the Church of Shadows, in New Hampshire. She also claims to have been Edward Spellman's secretary and tasked to protect Sabrina. Though Madame Satan was in love with Edward Spellman, as is in the recent comic, her heart truly belongs to Satan and her ambitions of becoming Queen of Hell. She manipulates her way into Sabrina's confidence and masterfully leads her down the path of night as directed by the Dark Lord. She is adept at astral projection, sympathetic magic, teleportation, and delights in causing trouble with her magic.
Father Faustus Blackwood, played by Richard Coyle, is the current High Priest of the Church of Night and the Dean of the Academy of Unseen Arts. He used to be Edward Spellman's mentor until the student eventually surpassed the teacher and became the High Priest of the Church of Night. Father Blackwood is a staunch traditionalist who reinstituted several practices that had fallen into disuse during the reign of Edward Spellman for their barbarism. He believes in male supremacy, and his character is a representative of the patriarchy, which is domineering, power-hungry, manipulative, and abusive. He's also a misogynist prig who runs a fraternity with secret plans to take over the Church of Night. Blackwood is married to Lady Constance, though he has frequent sexual dalliances, which is a disgusting abuse of his spiritual office. He has two legitimate children and at least one illegitimate teenage daughter named Prudence Knight. Blackwood is a powerful warlock who is adept at telekinesis and summoning. The character is possibly named after German alchemist Johann Georg Faust, who in German legend sold his soul to the devil. The surname Blackwood could be a reference to Algernon Blackwood, the English author of ghost stories.
The Weird Sisters are the mean girls of the Academy of the Unseen Arts, and initially the banes of Sabrina's existence. They seem to hate Sabrina for being a half-breed and revel in tormenting her every chance they get. The sisters consist of Prudence Knight, played by Tati Gabrielle, Agatha, played by Adeline Rudolph, and Dorcas, played by Abigail F. Cohen. All three witches are orphans without knowledge of their family connections. They were raised together in the Church of Night and are devout members. Prudence, the leader of the Weird Sisters, is the secret illegitimate daughter of Father Blackwood, who provided for her after her mother's suicide. The three Weird Sisters are powerful witches who are adept in all sorts of spellcasting, especially cursing, hexing, and poppet magic. They're also excellent at illusion manipulation, mind control, teleportation, and telekinesis. The sisters have adopted a Wednesday Addams Gothic style attire and appear in issue number 7 of the comic as a trio of adult witches, more appropriately known for their skills in foretelling the future. The original sisters are definitely based off of the Macbeth witches. The character of Dorcas is probably named from Dorothy Good, known as Dorcas thanks to a clerical error. She was the youngest witch accused and jailed in the Salem trials. Being only 4 or 5 at the time, she was likely coerced into confessing and implicating her own mother as a witch. Agatha might be named after Agatha Harkness, a fictional witch and Salem survivor from the Marvel Universe, who becomes the mentor to the Scarlet Witch and is the mother of Nicholas Scratch, a villainous wizard of the Fantastic Four series.
Nicholas Scratch, played by Gavin Leatherwood, is a student at the Academy of Unseen Arts. He has more progressive ideas than most other members of the Church of Night and is an acolyte of Edward Spellman's teachings. He is a handsome, confident, promiscuous, and intelligent young warlock who seems to have a romantic interest in Sabrina. Nick has shown himself to be a friend to Sabrina and has been willing to assist her with protecting the mortal world. He is adept at warding, necromancy, and summoning. The character's name, Nicholas Scratch, is a composite of two English folkloric names for the devil, Old Nick and Old Scratch, or Mr. Scratch.
The humans of Greendale are no slouches when it comes to magic, and Sabrina's human friends are gifted with some degree of special ability. The mortal friends' ancestral histories are introduced and we think will be heavily featured in the second part of the first season story arc.
Rosalind Walker, played by Jazz Sinclair, is Sabrina's mortal best friend. Roz, as she is known by her friends, is the teenage daughter of Greendale's minister. She is intelligent, confident, outspoken, and compassionate. She is socially conscious and willing to fight for the underdog, including championing women's rights at Baxter High. Roz is diagnosed with degenerative myopia, which will leave her blind within a few months. This hereditary blindness has afflicted the women of her family for generations. Roz later finds out from her Nana Ruth, played by L. Scott Caldwell, that the blindness is the result of a curse put on them by the witches for publicly accusing one of the Greendale 13 of witchcraft. Nana Ruth also tells Roz that she has the cunning that begins to exhibit when the women of their family start to go blind. The cunning confers upon the women hereditary psychic powers in the form of visions and being able to see ghosts and supernatural beings. We can't help wonder why Nana Ruth never mentioned this to Roz before.
Susie Putnam, played by Lachlan Watson, is Sabrina's other mortal best friend at Baxter High. Susie is queer and struggles with the binary genders imposed upon her by their father and the townsfolk of Greendale. Susie is bullied at school by the football players for being different, and the school's principal, Hawthorne, turns a blind eye to the abuse. Susie's gender is never stated in the show, but the character appears to be positioned to identify as non-binary or even possibly as trans. Susie exhibits psychic powers with the ability to see ghosts, including the ghosts of her ancestor, Dorothea Putnam, played by Anastasia Bandy. Susie's ancestor, Dorothea, was a pirate and frontierswoman who helped the original coven escape persecution in Scotland and brought them to Greendale. Dorothea's ghost seems to be having an influence over Susie, but it remains to be seen if she has some kind of secret agenda or plan for Susie.
Daniel Webster, played by John Rubenstein, is a human lawyer who in his earlier life made a pact with Satan to be the best lawyer in the world. Daniel was also an expert in witch law and was an acquaintance of Edward Spellman. He is a self-taught magician who used magic to become a legendary lawyer. He made his deal with the devil and began winning every case he took on, but soon realized that all of his clients were criminals who were actually guilty of the crimes they were charged with. Tragically, one of his clients was a depraved serial killer who he helped escape conviction and later murdered his young daughter. Racked with guilt, Daniel lost all hope, began drinking heavily, and gave up his practice. When Sabrina was charged with breach of promise, Daniel successfully defended her during her trial. The character of Webster gets his name from the 1936 short story by Stephen Vincent Bennett, The Devil and Daniel Webster, in which a lawyer defends the case of a farmer who made a deal with the devil. This story refers to the 17th century Salem, Massachusetts statesman and lawyer of the same name. A powerful orator, the real Webster was a phenomenon of his day, whose court speeches were transcribed and printed for the reading public.
Okay, now that we've introduced our witches, let's talk about the world they live in. These witches inhabit the fictional town of Greendale, located somewhere in the Midwestern U.S., not far from the Archie town of Riverdale. The setting has a timeless 60s, 1970s feel with no cell phones usually seen, but they do have computers and the internet. The fashion, music, and classic horror references all help to reinforce the retro vibe.
The magical world and lore of Greendale is just as interesting as the characters inhabiting it. Despite living in the same town, the witches inhabit a secret and separate society from that of the humans, which they guard fiercely. The witches are divided into covens, which appear to operate more or less autonomously under the leadership of a male high priest. As high priest, he is the embodiment of Satan's will on earth, an inversion of the Catholic priest or Protestant pastor roles. The witches' history in Greendale goes back to at least the 17th century. The original coven was known as the Hill People to the mortal settlers of the area. This Hill People reference seems to be more Texas Chainsaw, or the Hills Have Eyes, than a nod to fairy lore, no doubt due to the cannibalistic tendency of these witches. They created the tunneling system in the mountains, probably for their dark rites. The coven was later run off their land by Harvey Kinkle's family, the Von Kunkels, who were Dutch trappers and hunters. The Von Kunkels and their descendants were known as witch hunters by the coven. The Von Kunkels appropriated the tunnels and started a lucrative mining operation. Stories began circulating that the mining tunnels in Greendale went clear down to hell. Harvey tells Sabrina of his deeply traumatic childhood vision of the devil in the mines and of the present smell of sulfur. Greendale, like so many towns, was affected by witch trials. In 1692, a witch hunt was conducted in the town, and 13 women, known as the Greendale 13, were found guilty of witchcraft and hung in the town's forest. Unbeknownst to the human townsfolk, the 13 women were actual witches from the Greendale Coven, who were sacrificed by their fellow witches for the greater good of their coven in order to appease the bloodlust of the mortals.
The coven, or religious body of their society, is the Church of Night, also referred to as the Path of Night. The Church of Night is a satanic, spiritual, and magical path where the witches worship Satan as their dark lord and savior. So far, he's the only deity introduced which is reflective of the witches' patriarchal society. Their religion seems to be an inversion of Catholicism, with their rites being portrayed as perversions of their corresponding Catholic ones. Their book of scripture is the Dark Lord's Satanic Bible, which appears to be a riff on Anton LaVey's Satanic Bible, published in 1969. The Church of Night and their whole religion is led and run by men only, and like many organized religions, there is a deep undercurrent of misogyny. Female witches have very little power, and none appear to be in positions of leadership. Witch justice appears to be as harsh as their religion also. In one episode, an infernal summons is issued for the Spellmans to stand trial in the Court of Witches before the whole coven for Sabrina's refusal to sign the Book of the Beast. Witch law is guilty until proven innocent, and they are stripped of their powers. The Infernal Three are the judge creatures presiding over the trial. The legal proceeding is framed like a victim blaming sexual assault trial. Sabrina is told she was leading the devil on with her clothing and is shamed for not consummating things with the devil. She is even called a tramp. When Webster argues her half-mortality entitles her to mortal law, Faustus replies that Sabrina must submit to the witch trial classics of trial by water or being stripped and examined for a witch's mark.
The sharp contrast in morality and values between the witches and the human citizens of Greendale is frequently showcased. The witches' open and hedonistic way of life is paralleled against Greendale's puritanical values. Nicholas Scratch tells Sabrina that witches are aces at passion and lust, but when it comes to love, true love, not so much. These witches are polyamorous, or at least promiscuous, and sexually liberated. Underlying these sexy fun times are relationships of control and abuse with Satan and those that rule in his name. Nick continues, "Our Dark Lord is a jealous Lord. He wants us to love him and only him. Selfish, isn't it? And not unlike the Abrahamic God, if I say so myself." The amoral values of the witch is a common theme seen in the records of witch trials in Europe and America. In the U.S., where puritanical morals and values still heavily permeate the dominant American culture, any path that deviates from this dogmatic paradigm is branded heretical. The witches of this world hold fast to their traditions, which are never questioned or challenged. Many barbaric traditions remain uncontested and continue to be performed. Edward Spellman abolished some of these traditions during his tenure as high priest. He also wanted to institute a reform to the Church of Night that would allow witches to marry mortals. Unfortunately, after his death, everything went back to status quo. One of the most barbaric traditions of the witching world is the Feast of Feasts, which is one of their holiest holidays. The feast commemorates Sister Freya of the Founding Coven, who sacrificed herself to feed the rest through the winter and ensured the survival of the coven. During Feast of Feasts, female representatives from 14 families draw lots to be queen of the feast. The chosen queen of the feast is pampered for several days and then sacrificed for communal consumption on the day of the feast. Her body is consumed raw by the members of the coven. Sabrina's father banned the tradition during his tenure, but it was reinstituted by Father Blackwood.
A central tradition of the witch world is the dark baptism, which all witches must undergo to be initiated as a full-fledged member of the Church of Night. The dark baptism essentially means that they sell and bind their souls to Satan in return for youth, enhanced power, and his presumed protection. For the female witch, it means losing autonomy over her own body, for the Dark Lord has power over that too. Sabrina was to undergo the ritual on October 31st, the night of her 16th birthday, during a blood moon eclipse, an astronomical event that is said to occur only every 66 years. Very spooky. As explained to Sabrina, the dark baptism would be a rite of rebirth where she would leave her girlhood behind and make the satanic pact. At her ritual, Sabrina is cleansed by blue etheric flame, stripped of her garments, and anointed with human blood. She speaks her vows and then is told the fine print of the deal, as she is about to sign in his book with her own blood. There was also much emphasis on her remaining a virgin for the baptism, denying Sabrina sexual autonomy. This may have been more about obtaining rights to a pure soul. The episode seems to imply, at least to us, that Sabrina could have possibly been forced to submit to sexual intercourse with Satan against her will. Sexual initiation and predatory behavior, unfortunately, has long been lurking in the shadows of modern witchcraft traditions. We've linked the must-read recent post by Sarah Ann Lawless highlighting the current dangerous atmosphere in her pagan communities and explores the kink embedded in early Wicca. Sabrina fortunately found her courage with a little urging from her parents' spirits and ran away before signing, or worse. She, unlike many of her fellow witches, had not been brainwashed by the Academy of the Unseen Arts, thanks to her aunts who homeschooled her.
The Academy of Unseen Arts is the witches' magical training school located at Gehenna Station. In rabbinic literature, Gehenna, or the Valley of Hinnom, is a location in Jerusalem that is a destination of the wicked, which I imagine the Academy sees as a badge of honor. In the recent Sabrina comic, Madam Satan was punished by being sent to the pits of Gehenna, but you'll have to read the comic to find out why. The Academy building was built using sacred geometry, with each room designed to be a perfectly proportioned pentagon that locks with the one next to it, forming a kind of honeycomb or system of fractals. The building is made up of an unknown number of pentagons. The lobby has a satanic temple Baphomet statue, which got the show in a bit of legal hot water with the temple, but more on that later. The Academy curriculum includes classes such as conjuration, demonology, invocation, ritual magic, necromancy, herbalism, binding rituals, and Latin. Students can choose what their focus of study will be, that certain advanced classes, such as conjuration, first require the fulfillment of the Academy's general requirements. A student, however, can request a placement test for advanced classes if they have not previously met the general requirements. The Academy's environment is very competitive, and all new students undergo a period of severe hazing in which several students have been killed.
The show also makes mention of a path of light in reference to Sabrina's mortal life. It makes us wonder if there are any non-satanic witches of this world. The writers refer to Sabrina as a hedge witch, which they define as an unassociated witch without formal training, so perhaps she is being positioned to forge a new alternative path for the witches of her world. The term hedge witch comes from the Saxon word hectessa. In the neo-pagan community, hedge witchery is a very specific shamanic practice that involves crossing the hedge, also known as trance work, or journeying, to contact spirits in order to learn from them and bring back knowledge to the material world. The hedge represents the border between the material world and the other world, as they also used to mark the bounds of property. Hedge witches also perform healing and divinatory work, among other services. To read more on this, check out Sarah Ann Lawless's wonderful blog post, Hedge Witchery, written in 2009. Links to her post and incredible blog will, of course, be in the show notes on our website.
The flavors of Rosemary's Baby and other horror classics of its time definitely inspired the chilling adventures. The Church of Night and the Satanic Witches of Greendale are right in keeping with the tropes of the satanic 70s witch, so popular with the horror of the decade. This was a sexy, subversive, fashionable, and dark new breed of witch. The same witch style that is now flourishing is a rehashing of this particular witch style. Check out the New World Witchery blog post on the 70s witch archetype, link in the notes. And do check out the wonderful New World Witchery podcast and the blog at newworldwitchery.com. The witch of 1970s horror is usually involved in the historic scapegoat laundry list of crimes against God and man. They are depicted as cannibalistic, murderous, sexually deviant, and vengeful witches sworn to the forces of evil for material gain, earthly power, and pleasure. All the other satanic tropes are present as well. Witches sign their name in Satan's book with their own blood, forfeiting their immortal soul and entering a contract binding them to the Dark Lord's service. In return, Satan gives them magical powers and preternaturally long life. Satan also has a taste for virgins, and Sabrina was a firstborn child promised to darkness via her father's satanic pact. This type of fictional satanic witch even flavors Sabrina's comic book origins, where the witches gleefully cause mischief, seduce mortals, and cannot fall in love. These tropes were also saturating the U.S. popular consciousness during this decade and were at the heart of the satanic panic of the following decades, despite investigations confirming these were the fever dreams of a puritanical imagination. Although the witches of the show worship Satan and embrace hedonism like some Satanists do, they are essentially modeled after the classic satanic witch as defined by the Christian church of the medieval and early modern periods of history. In fact, the outright patriarchy and sexism of the witches' society in the show would probably cause a real-world Satanist to break out in hives and boils. Oh my!
Modern Satanist groups are varied and diverse, but they all share a belief or philosophy that embraces individualism, self-centrism, pride, nonconformity, autonomy, and the rejection of socially established morality. They embrace Satan either as an archetype or as a deity that embodies all of these characteristics. Satanist groups can be loosely classified into three general types that can be described as rationalist, theist, and reactionist. Rationalist Satanism does not believe in a literal Satan, but sees him as an archetype or metaphorical projection of their highest personal potential. Rational Satanists see themselves as the most important person and therefore as the god. Their philosophy is non-theist, skeptical, and scientific. Two examples of rational Satanism are the Church of Satan, founded by Anton Sanders LaVey, and the Satanic Temple, founded by Lucian Greaves and Malcolm Jarry. Theistic Satanism is an umbrella term for religious beliefs that see Satan as a deity or supernatural force worthy of worship and supplication. Followers of this type of Satanism are sometimes referred to as traditional Satanists or spiritual Satanists. For them, Satan is the god of freedom, individuality, sexuality, hedonism, creativity, and success. Some theistic groups are devotional and polytheistic, and others also include ceremonial magic as part of their practices. An example of theistic Satanism is the Church of Azazel, founded by Diane Vera. Reactive Satanism refers to groups of individuals, mainly adolescents, who practice Satanism as a form of inverted Christianity. Satan is still seen as an evil entity as defined by Christianity, but who is worthy of worship rather than being shunned or feared. It is often a path of antisocial rebellion in a Christian society. Reactive Satanists fully buy into the Christian scare propaganda regarding Satanism and are often inspired by elements of black metal, rock music, horror imagery, and a general philosophy of degradation. Two groups who do not identify as Satanists but follow a left-handed path are Luciferianism and the Temple of Set. Luciferianism is a left-handed path influenced by Gnosticism. Luciferians do not worship Satan, but instead venerate and model themselves after Lucifer, who they see as a symbol of enlightenment, independence, and human progression. Some Luciferians regard Lucifer as an actual deity, while others see him as an archetype. The Temple of Set, founded by Michael Aquino and several others, is an occult initiatory and religious movement who believes that Satan's true name is Set, the ancient Egyptian deity of chaos. Setians revere Set but do not worship him, and they see him as a teacher and a guide. The temple places great emphasis on the development of the individual with self-deification as the ultimate goal. On the witchcraft side of things, there are some traditional witchcraft paths that incorporate elements of Luciferianism, such as the Robert Cochrane tradition, of which the Clan of Tubal Cain is one example, and Andrew Chumley's Cultus Sabbati, to name a few.
As you can see from the very broad discussion of real-world Satanism, it is a belief system or philosophy of life that embraces the self-empowerment, growth, enlightenment, and autonomy of the individual. It does not practice or condone violence, murder, and other criminality as part of their practices. Some Satanist groups actively incorporate political activism, focus on protecting the rights and autonomy of the individual as part of their organizational missions and practices. The show also had some legal troubles during the run of its first season. In early November 2018, the Satanic Temple filed a copyright infringement lawsuit against Warner Brothers and Netflix over their copying of their Baphomet statue and its use in the show. The Academy of Unseen Arts displays a large Baphomet statue in their central lobby that very closely resembles the Satanic Temple's statue called Baphomet with Children, which was commissioned from sculptor Mike Porter about 5 years ago. The statue depicts two children staring up at Baphomet as if worshiping him. The temple stated that their copyrighted statue appeared on the show without their permission, and in doing so, Warner Brothers and Netflix committed copyright infringement, violated their trademark, and injured the temple's business reputation. The Satanic Temple stated in their complaint, among other things, the statue was designed and commissioned to be a central part of its efforts to promote First Amendment values of separation of church and state and equal protection. They felt that the show's prominent use of the statue as the focal point of the Academy of Unseen Arts and its association with evil, cannibalism, and murder blurred and tarnished their statue as a mark of the Satanic Temple. They demanded relief in more than $150 million. On November 21, 2018, it was reported that the Satanic Temple had amicably settled their lawsuit against Warner Brothers and Netflix. The Satanic Temple statue would be acknowledged in the credits of episodes that had already been filmed. The remaining terms of the settlement were subject to a confidentiality agreement.
I'd like permission to study the Necronomicon.
Now it's time for the magic. Let's take a look at how the magic of the Chilling Adventures measures up to the real practices. The magic of this world was mostly subtle, with none of the zappiness or pyrotechnics that are typically seen of Hollywood. This would be considered a magical realism. There was also so much spellcasting that we struggled to include everything. We will instead be just focusing on our favorites and on the magic with the most substance. So, let's dive right in and begin with the quintessential and sometimes controversial practices of witchcraft known as cursing. Just like the horror films that inspired the series, there are curses to spare in the Chilling Adventures. The most obvious are performed by the Weird Sisters. Tormenting mortal boys is their favorite pastime and includes seduction, glamour, hypnosis, mind control, and the classic stealing of their manhoods. The sisters magically capture their male potency, represented as caged birds. There is a long history of spells to steal men's genitals and cause impotence. Witch trial records and contemporary treatises are full of accounts of witches causing impotence by stealing and trapping a small animal to represent the victim's penis. Witch hunters of the time seem to be fixated on this particular diabolical activity. Witches were considered threats to the social order in general, and sexual deviance in particular. By emasculating men and robbing them of their generative powers, witches were seen as a direct threat to the patriarchal social order. They were accused of stealing the members, keeping them caged or in a bird's nest, and fed with oatmeal, only to be released once the owner would come to beg it back. Witches were also said to cast glamours to convince a man that his penis had vanished from his body. Most often, however, were the curses to restrict or prevent erections. These were essentially spells to punish infidelity by preventing intercourse, or to stop infidelity by causing impotence when attempting sex with all but the spouse or the witch. This last type of curse is still popular today, along with a slew of other love spells designed to punish a wandering lover. Hell hath no fury like a witch scorned. The Weird Sisters use another old curse, this time upon Sabrina. These sisters do not mess around. This Mean Girls Coven of Three demonstrates their racism and violence with this curse. And Hilda diagnoses it as a blood curse, one that would slowly but steadily wear down the victim's health, will, and sanity until ruin and eventually death. This chant is from Paul Hewson's book, Mastering Witchcraft. Recommended by Hewson only as a last resort, this is a nasty medieval curse called the Operation of Grand Bewitchment. This complex rite of sympathetic magic calls for use of a poppet, among other things, which the Weird Sisters are not shown using. We simply see them arrive and chant the Dog Latin Withering curse. It is possible they already performed the spell in its entirety before appearing and verbally slapping Sabrina again in person, as the Weird Sisters are shown using dolls to curse a few other times throughout the series.
These witches may not mess around, but they do play with dolls, or more precisely, poppets. Madame Satan in particular uses a lot of poppets in her magic. She stabs her victim's likeness with pins and puppets a scarecrow to menace Sabrina. The word poppet from medieval English means doll. The use of these dolls in sympathetic magic, as seen in The Chilling Adventures, is very popular in European folk magic. Similar practices exist in folk magic around the world. Dolls would be made from natural found materials like fruit, leaves, and roots. Roots are very common, as some plants' root systems grow multiple branches, resembling the limbs on a human body. Simple household items like scraps of cloth or wax are also used, plus some token of your subject. Hair, toenails, a bit of their clothing, or something containing their bodily fluids connect the doll to the person. We see Madame Satan steal hair from the Spellman's brushes and cut huge chunks from some clothing. However, a dirty sock or a used tissue would serve as well and would certainly be more discreet. The use of human representations continues in modern magic with some interesting variations. Dollar store plastic and cloth dolls are handy for the busy witch on a budget, though doll spell kits are widely available, complete with dress candles and appropriate herbs from occult shops. In the Christmas special, Madame Satan consumes a gingerbread Spellman family, which would be a delicious alternative to using dolls to absorb an enemy's life force. Try thinking about pantomimed ritual cannibalism next time you nibble on this holiday treat. Ah, you're welcome. These diabolical ladies aren't the only ones slinging Malefica in The Chilling Adventures. Even Sabrina is tempted to get in on the action and curses her high school's principal. Sabrina recruits Ambrose to help curse Principal George Hawthorne at the midnight hour, hoping to mildly traumatize him into taking several days off from school. Good to note that Sabrina refuses to kill the principal, as Ambrose half-jokingly suggests. As Hawthorne is terrified of spiders, the pair conjures up an arachnophobic nightmare with the help of Hilda's spider familiars. The song "I Put a Spell on You" plays in the background as Ambrose puts a picture of Hawthorne in a terrarium. The photo is used much like the poppets are to connect with the spell's target and direct the spiders.
The show also has several instances of reversal and protection spells, many of them, of course, spoken in Latin. Older ancient Latin has always been regarded as a magically potent language, and it's no wonder Latin is being used in the show for their spoken incantations. Unfortunately, we do not speak Latin, so we can't translate or attest to the correctness of the Latin used in the show, but a cursory search online will turn up many comments from speakers of Latin that state that a lot of the Latin used on the show is full of grammatical errors and in many instances doesn't really make a lot of sense. But we leave that debate to the Latin experts out there who are fans of the show.
Sabrina casts a protection spell over Harvey, which keeps him from dying in a mind collapse caused by the weird sisters. Nicholas Scratch later casts the same protection spell over the Kinkle house to keep them safe from the Greendale 13. The protection spell is simple, with the witch directing their protective intent onto the target and chanting, "Qui affecto proteo mixtisque iubas serpentibus et posteris meis stirpicu." Our online research of this protection spell revealed it being referred to again and again as an ancient Latin or Roman spell of protection, without any citation to the source for the spell. I suppose we are supposed to believe it is ancient because the internet says so. So would it be. In all seriousness, many protection incantations are pulled from many sources, some of them indeed ancient and in Latin, including the Bible, prayer and oration books, medieval grimoires, and ancient Roman prayer and magical texts, to name a few. Some are even pulled from archaeological materials excavated at ancient Greek and Roman sites, such as curse and prayer tablets. when Sabrina's astral body is attacked by the demon Apophis, Ambrose saves her by chanting another Latin invocation over her physical body. Liberate tu temet, ex fuga, Sabrina. The phrase liberate tu temet, ex fuga, loosely translates to save yourself from hell. Interestingly, this Latin phrase was used in the 1997 science fiction horror film Event Horizon. Hilda makes Sabrina protection charms to keep in her pockets, and Zelda tells her in exasperation, "Honestly, Hilda, what's next? Sage crystals?" Many protective charms and talismans are made small so that they can be carried by the person being protected, and pockets are useful in convenient places to hide them. And yes, sage and crystals used with respect and intention are indeed protective, despite Zelda's negative association of them with mainstream New Age practices.
Besides protection outside a witch's body, we see them use a purification spell to protect the inside as well. Aunt Zelda tells Sabrina that the temple of her body needs to be purified and cleansed of its toxins. This is all in preparation for her baptism. Hilda, being the family's herbalist, creates a thick green smoothie for Sabrina to drink. Her ingredients mentioned were eggs, a cupful of milk, agrimony, rosemary, a pinch of John the Conqueror root, and some other unnamed herbs from the garden. Agrimony is a powerful protection herb of the rose family, used for banishing and spell reversal. It's a medicinal herb used for many things and is considered a cure-all, with powerful astringent and tension-relieving qualities. It was once used to detect witches in medieval Europe. When braided into a wreath with rue, maidenhair fern, broom, and ground ivy, it is supposed to reveal the presence of witches and hold them fast to the threshold. Also known as fairy wand, it was a favorite herb of Scottish witches for reversing elf shot and curses. John the Conqueror is a powerful hexbreaker and a staple of magical practices of the African diaspora. The root is used whole as a talisman to promote strength, success, love, courage, and luck. According to the lore surrounding the plant, its powers were given to it by an African prince who retained his personal power while enslaved in America. With his cunning and bravery, he managed to escape his bonds and defeat the devil himself. But it is also poisonous. Ingestion has severe purgative effects on the bowels and can easily be absorbed through broken skin. So if you use this root's oil, be sure to wear gloves or it'll ruin your night. The common culinary herb rosemary is another potent magical herb and medicinal powerhouse. Rosemary has a long list of uses in European magic and can be substituted for many herbs. Protection, purification, and healing are only a few of its many magical properties. Its scent is also invigorating and uplifting. This is a must-have herb for any witch that works with plants. Fresh, dried, or as an essential oil, rosemary won't let you down. And tanis root is also mentioned in their list of ingredients. This fictional herb is mentioned in several 1970s horror movies, most famously in Rosemary's Baby. A stinky herb, it could be analogous to asafoetida. This devil's dung is a very powerful banishing and protective herb that contains large amounts of sulfur. Used for exorcism and reversing curses, its powerful odor drives away evil and pretty much anything with a sense of smell.
Aside from these purification and protection spells, we also get to see these witches try curse breaking. Sabrina tries to break the curse laid on her by the Weird Sisters. While scrubbing vigorously in the shower, she chants over and over again, "If truly I am cursed today, let water wash the hex away." This is quick thinking, but it is a basic bitch of a cleansing. At the least, use blessed salt for a scrub with some rosemary oil for good measure. But a single shower wouldn't be sufficient for a curse like the grand bewitchment. Fortunately, the aunts know better. Hilda performs a curse diagnosis with an egg to see what's been done to her beloved niece. She tells Sabrina to break an egg into a bowl to determine if there is any residual energy from the curse. This is a version of Olimpia, or egg cleansing, a Latin folk magic practice found in curanderismo, hoodoo, and santeria, among other traditions. The egg is a pure, perfect empty vessel waiting to be filled with energy, making it perfect for sucking up psychic gunk. Commonly, a simple ritual is performed where an egg is swept over the body of the afflicted to absorb malefica from the aura. Some say simply holding the egg with a prayer is enough contact for a quick diagnosis. Then the egg is cracked into a bowl of water and its appearance interpreted: cloudiness, stringy bits, bloody spots, and funky smells all indicate varying levels of attack. If you see bubbles around it, congratulations! The curse or evil eye has been successfully absorbed by the egg. Sabrina's egg is blood red, both yolk and white parts. Yikes. Hilda states that the blood curse lingers, and if left untreated, will eat slowly away at Sabrina's health, will, and sanity. Those sucky bitches! Hilda's prescription is a regimen of saltwater baths and use of reversing candles for a couple of weeks. Another perfectly sound magical recommendation by Hilda. These are great rituals to perform monthly at the dark moon by anyone practicing magic, or even taking public transportation, for that matter. For curses, baths are especially helpful because the energy of a curse is said to dry up one's luck, health, and happiness. If salt and herbal baths aren't enough, 3-day-old coffee, dark beer, or buttermilk baths would be next to try. If all fails, the nuclear option of cleansing baths is to add a scant cap full of ammonia. It will strip off everything, right along with any protections and blessings as well.
While we are personally disappointed that Sabrina never uses tarot, our favorite tool, she does perform some divination with fruit. When Sabrina expresses her doubts about undergoing the dark baptism, her cousin Ambrose suggests she pose the question to the Malum Malus. He explains that the Malum Malus is an apple that can show you the future, illuminating one path over the other. When referring to the apple as male, it is known as the apple of evil. When referring to it as a female, it is the fruit of knowledge. For this divination, she is to pick the oldest tree in an orchard. The older it is, the more it is seen, and the wiser. Sabrina finds the tree and chants, "Hickory pickory, where shall this girl go? She'll go east, she'll go west, she'll go to the crow's nest. Hickory pickory, hickory pickory." Sabrina taking a bite from the Malum Malus and gaining knowledge of the future is an interesting callback to the tree of knowledge. The Malum Malus is a Latin phrase that means bad or evil apple or apple tree. As an adjective, the word malus means bad or evil. And as a noun, it seems to mean apple. Interestingly, the original biblical text never specified the fruit as being an apple, but as merely the fruit from the tree of knowledge. The idea that it was an apple was a later interpretation, probably beginning with the Latin Vulgate Bible of the 4th century CE and with Albrecht Dürer's famous 1504 engraving, which depicts the first couple standing next to an apple tree. Dürer's work became a template for future artists depicting the tree as an apple. The incantation spoken by Sabrina is taken almost verbatim from a Scottish counting rhyme for children that exists in various forms since before 1820. It should be noted that there are various Scottish and English variants of this poem, including the popular Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe children's rhyme. Now, if this divination sounds intriguing to any of you, in theory it could be effective, but maybe with a few tweaks. Firstly, definitely ask the tree's consent and make an offering before beginning. Once the apple has been selected and consumed, one would need to induce a receptive state in which to receive the desired vision. Various trance techniques could be employed under the tree, or even a nap will do if conditions are safe to do so. If not, bringing the apple home to complete the ritual in privacy and safety should also work. The magical associations of apples are almost all Venusian, so this divination would probably work best for questions involving love, beauty, fertility, and prosperity. Among the Celts, the apple is also associated with the dead, so this could equally be effective for communicating with the ancestors as well.
In The Chilling Adventures, we get to see the witches use another common technique of the craft, soul flight or astral projection. Sabrina and Ambrose's consciousness just seems to pop into the other world, but in one scene we see Zelda's etheric double sing through the floor. They chant another Latin phrase, Vola anima per eterna. The soul flies eternal as a trance trigger. This is pretty close to one astral projection method where you create an energetic double of yourself floating above you to project your consciousness into. Then you are free to float up or down depending on what realm you wanted to visit. You are not limited to the astral realm while in astral form. You can travel to other planes to learn from ascended spirits, talk with your guides, and can visit anywhere on our earthly world. It's the cheapest vacation you'll ever take. You must, however, be sure to mind your manners, taking caution when interacting with other entities, and be sure to travel back the way you came to avoid leaving bits of your soul behind. The Church of Night lore says it's a dangerous practice, as their astral plane is meant only for the dead. Birds are the form taken by the psychopomps, who act like a regulating police force. If you spend too much time in the astral plane, away from your body, they will assume you have died and will come to collect you. In worldwide myths, certain animals were said to carry off the souls of the dead, if it was not the soul itself transforming. Birds were very common examples. Psychopomps, like Hermes and Hecate of classical Greece, are deities or entities that would be responsible for guiding the dead souls to the nether realms. These liminal gods are usually also patrons of witchcraft and magic, or of podcasts that discuss such things. No doubt the threat of psychopomps coming to fly away with your soul is a great plot device. But it's not that easy for your soul to be stolen away. Your energetic bodies are linked to the physical. This is often visualized as a silver cord from the solar plexus. Humans often wander unintentionally during sleep as well as during deep trance-like states, including while under the influence of sedatives and various drugs. It is more likely that your vulnerable empty body could be taken advantage of by stray ghoulies, as Sabrina learned the hard way. A demon attacks Sabrina's astral body and tries to kill her or possess her. Powerful entities can do that, while less powerful ones can form a parasitic attachment to your astral body and feed off you, causing energetic imbalance and illness. Other dangers lurk in Sabrina's astral realm as well. They speak of a monstrous soul eater that prowls the realm. Something so powerful, however, would likely only be in the nether realms, furthest from our physical world. Not sure why you'd want to go there, but the witch would require a guide to travel to such a dangerous remote plane of existence. When intentionally practicing soul flight for any reason, it is always a good idea to ward your space. Invoke your spirit familiars and use a protection amulet or charm of some kind. The Spellmans have a fellow witch keep vigil over their body, but this is only helpful if the guardian has some kind of extra perception to detect incoming nasties. They do lay down in a ring of candles, so this may be argued is their warded circle, though we see no ritual while setting the candles.
Some witches use spirits to protect their body and property during astral travel. In European folklore, these spirits, known as familiars, also assisted witches with their magical workings. They could appear in numerous guises, often as animals, but could also take a humanoid form. Sabrina gets her spell for summoning a familiar from the Demonomicon, named after a book in Dungeons & Dragons dealing with demons. In the world of the Chilling Adventures, familiars are traditionally bred for service, chosen from a catalog, and enter into a slave-like relationship with their witch. These imps and spirits in animal form are bound to their masters and die shortly after the witch does. The appearance of these shape-shifting, non-corporeal helpers may vary, but European witch hunters and theologians believe they would most often take the form of a small animal. Toads, hares, birds, and of course, cats were the most frequently mentioned in the trial documents. We are introduced to several familiars throughout the series. Hilda has a number of spiders, which is very appropriate for her green witch style. Zelda has a sleepy hound named Vinegar Tom, which is a reference to the 1976 play of the same name set during the 17th century English witch trials. The raven, Stolas, Madame Satan's familiar, gets the most screen time here, though. Stolas is one of 72 demons in the Ars Goetia, a book of the Lesser Key of Solomon. Ambrose is eventually gifted a familiar of supposedly the highest pedigree, none other than the well-known biblical demon Leviathan. According to the Book of Abermelin, he is associated with water and the West, and later with whales and other giant sea creatures as well. He's the gatekeeper to hell and is one of its demonic princes. This demon, synonymous with hugely monstrous creatures, comically takes the form of a teeny mouse on the show. Not coincidentally, the Church of Satan's official insignia, the Sigil of Baphomet, has this demon's name on its outer ring in Hebrew. But Sabrina ditches the mail order demon catalog and chooses instead to call a spirit that wants to partner with her as equals. Sabrina naturally has a black cat. Salem has been with her character since the very beginning in Archie Comics. This feline does not seem to be the same Salem of the 90s series or the cursed and transmogrified warlock of the Chilling Adventures comics. We were hoping to see this wonderful backstory of the comics version of Salem, but it looks like that won't be happening. And as much as we miss our much-beloved 90s snarky Salem, this version is definitely more accurate to the Northern European style of witchcraft used by the Church of Night. Sabrina summons a spirit familiar volunteer, in keeping with the essence of real-world witchcraft practices. She sneaks off to the forest at night to perform a simple summoning ritual. She rings a silver bell and declares, "Spirits of the forest, I pronounce my intentions to thee. Come forth and seek me, and equals we will be." She draws a circular sigil in the dirt and continues, "Not master and servant, but familiar to familiar, to share our knowledge, our spirit, and traits." It is interesting to see that it takes a while for the familiar to appear, as it can sometimes take days and repeated summonings for a spirit to make itself known. Sabrina is very quick to accept Salem, however. Summoning is only the first step in forming a familiar relationship. In actual practice, you wouldn't just jump into a pact with a spirit. The spirit should be screened or vetted over time to be sure that they are the best fit and are not something with a malicious intent or maligning influence. Once they have been proved appropriate for the work you want to do, you would outline or negotiate the terms of the working relationship, including the type and frequency of offerings given in exchange for their magical aid and knowledge. Does that sound similar to the Diabolical Pact? It should. Satan is a spiritual entity, after all. Just be sure not to offer up more than you can realistically handle. You know, like your mortal soul or your firstborn. Try food, tobacco, or booze instead. Spirits are a thirsty bunch.
Beside poppets and familiars, There is old school string magic used by these witches. As Sabrina says, sometimes the oldest, simplest magic works best. Indeed. String of various primary colors can be used in spellcraft to focus the will, draw something towards you, to trap an entity or effect in knots, braids, and weaves. It is a simple, sympathetic action that has a lot of creative applications beyond these. Of the examples in The Chilling Adventures, Madame Satan has the least believable. She creates an invisibility cloaking spell by encircling the group with white wool yarn. Does she always carry yarn in her pockets? Maybe that's how she skulks around so effectively. Always prepared, I guess. That particular spell is ludicrous, but certainly fun to watch. Sadly, invisibility spells won't literally make you invisible. They are glamours that keep one unnoticed, helping you to blend into a crowd and deflect attention by affecting the perception of those around you. Sabrina is shown performing the better versions of string magic. First, we see her summon the Weird Sisters with a Shakespearean-inspired string charm. The words are direct from Macbeth when the witches chant this to curse a sailor right before their first encounter with the ill-fated Scott. Sabrina wheels white string and twists the strand around a three-pronged branch, making a charm that looks like a net or basket. As she winds the thread, she draws her desire closer to her. The second and best of the string magic is used to trap a nasty spirit. Charms made from a single long thread are used as effective but simple spirit traps. Rowan crosses, God's eye thread charms, and dream catchers are only a few examples from the many around the world. Spirits are thought to be compelled to follow a straight line, the thread in this case, and end up tangled inside. In episode 5, Sabrina uses the children's string games, known as Cat's Cradle, for a binding spell. She incorrectly refers to it as a dream catcher, though while not technically true, the theory behind it is the same. She uses black yarn to make a binding net to hold the spirit, with help from Hilda's spiders. Her fingers move deftly, weaving a succession of string figures as she chants another Latin incantation. This ubiquitous children's string game possibly dates back to the Stone Age and may have originated in Asia. It can be used magically as evidenced by one German name for the game, Hexenspiel, or witch's game. String games are also used for meditation, divination, to tell stories and myths, and to teach mathematics. While typically played by a pair, string shapes can be made alone, with or without the help of one's toes, or in small groups for greater levels of complexity. For more on the history and anthropological significance of these string games, visit the International String Figure Association website at isfa.org or read the classic 1906 String Game Handbook, String Figures and How to Make Them, by Carolyn Furness Jane. Link to a digital transcript with illustrations can be found in the show notes. If used as a spirit trap, you can burn the still-woven string and banish the spirit back to whence it came after the binding has been performed. The really nasty ones that may be too strong to banish can be contained to keep them from harming again. Sabrina traps Batty Bat in a jam jar. No need to get fancy. Whatever you use, be sure it's durable and will not break and free the spirit. Seal it well with melted wax and place it somewhere removed from your home where it won't be disturbed, like the bottom of a lake or buried in a remote location or cemetery. Be sure to leave an offering to the land spirits. If burying it in a grave, be sure to get the permission of the dead first and leave an offering as well. For more on spirit traps and banishing, check out the blog post by Sarah Ann Lawless, linked in the show notes. The whole trouble with Batty Bat could have been avoided if Sabrina kept the Acheron puzzle box closed. A good example of why not to open mysterious old containers or bundles found buried on your property. It may be a cursed object or a hellspawn trapped in there, and no one wants to end up in their own version of The Conjuring. Batty Bat is initially imprisoned in the Acheron configuration by Edward Spellman. Acheron is the first river to be crossed in the underworld of Greek mythology. It is the river of pain which Charon ferries the souls of the dead across. The mirrored kaleidoscope puzzle box may feel like shades of Hellraiser, but it is a version of a reversing spell using a mirror-lined box. A mirror-lined box can contain the curses sent to you by an enemy and can send it right back to them.
Now that we've discussed how to put this demon down, let's get to know Batty Bat a bit better. She is a sleep demon who tortures her victims with nightmares. Batty Bat traps the Spellmans in a dream state to force them to break the containment spell, keeping her in their house. From Filipino folklore, Batty Bat is a tree spirit that manifests as an obese woman who is angered when her trees are cut down for lumber without permission. She appears and sits on your chest at night, paralyzing you with nightmares and suffocating you under her mass. She's the sleep hag, commonly reported with cases of sleep paralysis. There are many worldwide myths about this. European folklore usually has a cat, demon, or gargoyle sit on the dreamer's chest. In Africa, it is a monkey. Creepily enough, in Southeast Asia, Batty Bat is thought to cause sudden unexplained nocturnal death syndrome. Otherwise healthy men between 30 and 40 years old mysteriously die in their sleep without clear medical cause. Best guesses have included sleep apnea, cardiac arrhythmia, acute pancreatitis, or simply being scared to death.
The Spellmans do more than just trap nasty spirits. They also perform an exorcism rite on one of their human neighbors with great success. In the episode, An Exorcism in Greendale, Susie's Uncle Jesse is possessed by a demon and the Spellmans intervene. Exorcism is the expulsion or attempted expulsion of an evil spirit from a person or place. The episode has some good historical tidbits about demons and demonic possession. For instance, Ambrose explains to Sabrina that originally from the time of Homer, the word demon was used to describe a being of benevolence, and that this meaning had been perverted by the false church and now carried with it connotations of malevolence. In ancient Greece, a daemon was usually a nature or guardian spirit who was of a semi-divine nature, somewhere between a god and a mortal, who was usually created when a noble person or hero died. They usually acted as go-betweens for gods and mortals, delivering divine messages and blessings to mortals, or reporting bad behavior to the gods. Later, they came to be categorized by the ancient Greeks into two groups, the benevolent agathodaemons and the malevolent kakodaemons. With the rise of Christianity, daemons became demons. Our modern classical sense of the word is probably derived from Roman stories about kakodaemons. Interestingly, the Christian notion of a guardian angel probably also came out from the ancient Greek agathodaemons.
In the episode, Zelda tells Sabrina that cases of actual demonic possession are rare, which is the actual position held by the Catholic Church. Hilda also tells Sabrina that Jesse should be examined for a medical cause before assuming he is possessed, which is excellent advice. Even the Vatican requires all persons claiming to be possessed to be first examined by a medical doctor to rule out psychiatric or physical illness. And once medical causes are cleared, there is a list of phenomena that must be present to declare possession. Speaking in tongues is one of a long list to be satisfied. Sabrina is also correctly warned by her aunts about how demons prey on people's fears and engage in psychological attack against their targets. She's told to tell her friends to avoid contact with Jesse, as the contact would make them the target of the demon. Many clergy and psychiatrists who have counseled or treated possessed individuals have reported instances of direct and indirect physical and psychological attacks by the demonic entity, including some that occurred after they left the presence of the individual. In the episode, all three of Sabrina's friends come into direct physical contact with Jesse, and as a result become targets of the demon's psychological torture. Hilda once again offers an inspired remedy for the Scooby Gang to banish the nasty demon. She suggests that they bathe in a bit of blessed water from the Sea of Galilee, which always does the trick. While blessed water is available for sale from around the world, there's little to no way of actually verifying the authentic source, so possibly not the most practical advice, but serious cleansing of any kind would definitely be in order.
Later, Sabrina astral projects to Jesse's room to try to get the demon's name, which will help exorcise him. The demon, of course, lies and tells Sabrina his name is Mersesi, Sumerian overlord of gluttony, which is really ice cream spelled backwards. The demon indeed has a wicked sense of humor, but there is a real protective reason behind his lie. Mythology and folklore is full of tales of people gaining power over others, or even supernatural beings, by learning their true names. The learning of a being's true name allows one to know their true nature, giving one power over them. It also allows one to even perform magic against them. That demon wasn't about to give his true name to a witch. Sabrina eventually consults one of Ambrose's demonology books and figures out that the demon's real name is Apophis, who is depicted as a snake. He is a parasitic demon known as the devouring worm who feasts on his victims from the inside out. Apophis's possessions don't last long, so Jesse's days are numbered. Interestingly, Apophis is the ancient Egyptian spirit of evil, darkness, and destruction. He embodied chaos and was thus the opponent of light embodied by Ra, the sun god, and order and truth embodied by Maat. He was depicted as a large serpent, often with tightly coiled coils, to emphasize his huge size. Apophis is associated with earthquakes, thunder, darkness, storms, and death, and is sometimes linked to the god Set, who is also associated with chaos, disorder, storms, and darkness. Apophis represented everything the Egyptians feared: darkness, oblivion, and the loss of one's identity. In the show, Apophis is a parasitic demon, which is different from the concept of primordial chaos, but still represents destruction, whether it be of the natural order or the identity of an individual. As mentioned previously, with the rise of Christianity, many ancient deities, particularly those with darker aspects, were reduced to being demons. In Golden Dawn and Thelemic ceremonial magic, Apophis appears as part of the Typhon Apophis Set sign, which is used in various rituals, including the lesser ritual of the hexagram. Apophis also appears in the magical formula IAO, with I corresponding to Isis as nature being ruined by A, Apophis the destroyer, and restored to life by the Redeemer, Osiris, the letter O.
In the show, the exorcism of Jesse is performed by Sabrina, Hilda, Zelda, and Madam Satan. It should be noted that in their society, witches are not allowed to perform exorcisms because it is a Catholic rite in which priests call upon the power of the false god. In the Catholic Church, only bishops or priests who have been officially appointed by the diocese as exorcists can perform the rite of major exorcism. This rite of exorcism used by the four witches was written by Edward Spellman and given to them by Madame Satan. The real-life screenwriters behind the episode was M.J. Kaufman and Joshua Conkle. Joshua is one of the many awesome Sabrina screenwriters who is also a magical practitioner and has a deep love of horror. He's been making the podcast rounds and also discusses his Appalachian background and love of tarot, so also check out the links in our show notes to the interviews he's been doing. This brilliant rite relies on the power of the individual witch and the continuum of witches that predate her soul versus the Catholic rite, which places all the power on the false god. In other words, the witch's exorcism rite relies on the individual power of the witch, empowered further by the assistance of a long line of ancestors called upon during the ritual. These ancestors can be deities, family members, or other witches. The Catholic rite relies on God, the Holy Trinity, saints, archangels, and angels, not on the ancestors of the priest. The current Catholic rite of major or solemn exorcism was revised in January 1999. The prior exorcism rite dated back to 1614. The church requires the afflicted person give consent, if at all possible, before proceeding. Ideally performed in a chapel, it is advantageous to perform the ritual in a place dedicated to God's honor, and not, for instance, in the afflicted person's home, which is so often depicted in films. The priest finally demands, in the name of God, that the devil leave the possessed person's body. During the final ritual, the priest sprinkles everyone with holy water, lays his hands over the afflicted, and breathes over their face. Wielding a cross, the priest makes the sign of the cross both on himself and the possessed, and touches them with a Catholic relic. He also asks God to keep the evil from molesting the subject further, and to keep it far away, never to return.
In keeping with the show's inspiration from horror movies, there is a beautiful visual of Hilda, Sabrina, and Madame Satan walking slowly towards the Putnam House, which is straight out of the movie The Exorcist. The four witches together exorcise Apophis from Jesse, with Sabrina leading the ritual. They call on their ancestors, a host of witches, goddesses, and other witchy people. The ritual is simple but beautifully powerful, with the witches performing the calls together as they throw salt on Jesse. We call forth the witches from the shade, those who came before us and died, so that we might live. Visit us, sisters, intercede on our behalf. Visit us, sisters, intercede on our behalf. Visit us, sisters, intercede on our behalf. The historical witches called upon were Tituba, Mary Bradbury, Marie Laveau, and Sybil Leake. Tituba, the slave of Salem, was the first accused and caretaker to the Putnam girls whose hysteria sparked the trials. Mary Bradbury was another Salem witch who survived the panic due to the intercession of over 100 townsfolk who came forward to defend her. Her impressive list of descendants include the famous science fiction author Ray Bradbury. While it's possible the Salem accused were practicing a bit of folk magic, famous New Orleans voodoo Queen Marie Laveau and Sybil Leake may be the only witches in the list. Sybil Leake was a witch and occult author who became popular in the 1960s and 70s and has been called Britain's most famous witch. Marie Laveau was the 19th century, larger-than-life practitioner of voodoo, hoodoo, folk Catholicism, Native American and African spirituality. A free woman of mixed heritage, Marie has become synonymous with the New Orleans flavor of voodoo and inspired a vast amount of folklore, art, and literature. People still travel to the French Quarter to petition her grave with chalk X marks and to leave offerings. The other historical persons called in may not have been witches, but they were certainly exceptional and brilliant women ahead of their time. The medieval German abbess Hildegard von Bingen was a scientist, mystic, composer, physician, and theologian, among other things, who authored numerous books and music. Anne Boleyn, the ill-fated second wife of Henry VIII, was a well-educated, witty, and charismatic courtier. While never directly charged with witchcraft, rumors and Henry himself said she influenced him with sortilege, meaning spells or deceit.
They also call in several legendary witches. Two witches from rabbinical folklore were called upon, Lilith and the Witch of Endor. Lilith is the first wife of Adam, who became demoted to demoness after she left Adam and refused to submit to him sexually. Lilith became known as a sorceress and mother of demons, much like Madame Satan in the show. The Witch of Endor was sought out in the Old Testament to raise the spirit of Samhain for prophecy, though not much else is known. Witches from other legends were also called upon. Morgan Le Fay is the powerful Arthurian sorceress who is nearly equal to Merlin. Circe, hailing from the ancient Greek epics, she was said to be an extremely powerful and beautiful devotee of Hecate. From more recent American folklore, they mention Moll Dyer. The legend of Moll Dyer takes place in late 17th century Maryland. She was said to have been a widow, accused of witchcraft, and driven from her home, only to be found days later, dead and frozen to a large stone. Local lore persists to this day, surrounding the area where she was to have lived and died. She is said to haunt the area, causing accidents and abundant lightning. The boulder she died upon is said to now reside in front of the local historical society. It bears the marks of her hands, and many report feeling disturbed and ill when touching it. From across the pond, they call on Black Annis, who is a quintessential hag figure from English folklore. She is an ugly, child-eating, blue-faced monster with long iron claws and stringy black hair. She dwells in a cave guarded by a large old oak tree and wears the skins of her victims around her waist.
For good measure, they also evoke multiple goddesses of witchcraft and protectors of women. Hecate was the ancient Greek goddess of magic, witchcraft, necromancy, ghosts, crossroads, and other liminal spaces. She walks in darkness and is a protector and avenger of women. She was the daughter of the Titans Perseus and Asteria and had dominion over heaven, earth, and the sea. Some scholars argue that Hecate's origins trace back to Anatolia, though she was later incorporated into the Greek pantheon. Artemis is the virgin Olympian goddess of the hunt, nature, the moon, and therefore sometimes magic, chastity, and childbirth. Today she is seen as a protector of women and a feminist archetype. Aradia was the main character in American folklorist Charles Godfrey Leland's work Aradia, or The Gospel of the Witches, published in 1899. Aradia was a messiah of Italian witch cults sent to Earth by her mother, the goddess Diana, to teach witchcraft to the enslaved masses so that they could use it against their oppressors. In Wicca and some other forms of neo-paganism, Aradia is regarded as a moon goddess, and as one form of the great goddess. Luna is the embodiment of the moon in ancient Roman mythology and spirituality. She was often depicted as an aspect of the triple goddess along with Proserpina and Hecate. Juno was the patron and protector goddess of the Roman Empire and was known as Regina, or Heavenly Queen. She presided over all aspects of women's lives. Associated with Juno is also the mentioned Juventus, the Virgin. She was a patron of young warriors and was said to grant strength at critical moments. And for good measure, they also call in Celtic goddesses Nievan, Bev, and Maka of the Morrigan. These fierce battle deities would be merciless and show this demon a sticky, painful end in case this femme army failed to scare it back to hell.
Lastly, there is necromancy, the darkest and most dangerous of the sacred magics, death magic. According to Madame Satan, the slightest deviation of the incantation could kill all the participants, which is why Sabrina is warned that resurrection is generally a no-no. We are also told the underworld demands its price. It must be a balanced exchange of cosmic forces, a life for a life. Never to be done on mortals, bodily resurrection is only sometimes possible with witches. Hilda's resurrection is dependent solely on their garden, Cain Patch, a plot of dirt from the Holy Land soaked with the biblical blood of Cain. Hilda tells us that it is the most fertile soil on Earth and contains all the mysteries of life and death. Maybe all that time in the cursed ground is what helped Hilda become such an exceptional gardener? But as any horror fan knows, mortals come back wrong. As seen in the horror classic Night of the Living Dead, which is also referenced in the series, attempts at resurrecting mortals results in them coming back zombified. Worldwide folk magic and lore holds accounts of these zombies, or revenants, with a surprising amount occurring in Europe of the Middle Ages. Depicted as a soulless reanimated corpse, they are sometimes harbingers of death, share traits with folkloric vampires, or simply hang around at night and harass the family. What a terrible thing to think grandma's corpse coming back to bother you while you're trying to grieve. While there are a few notable mythical exceptions where mortals come back well, like Lazarus, most successful resurrections happen with gods, heroes, and elevated ancestors. The average person would be a shell, set to a specific task by the magician that controlled them, or a horrifying walking corpse at worst. Despite the warning, Sabrina dives in and it seems to thrill her. This may be the most reckless magical act Sabrina attempts in the series so far. She performs the rite with little knowledge of the energies invoked or the range of consequences for screwing it up. This attitude is even more disturbing as it requires Sabrina to commit murder. Granted, she does have a plan for reviving her sacrifice, but Sabrina's unsettling eagerness makes it a turning point for the character. Her hubris in attempting to cheat the cosmic order of life and death is truly chilling.
Aided by her infernal schoolmates, they sneak off to the woods to resurrect Harvey's brother like they were going to a party. An inverted pentagram is drawn in the dirt, and the dead man's garments are laid upon it, which is a sympathetic way of representing the spell's target. Besides being the stereotypical magical symbol for Hollywood Satanists, the inverted pentagram can be used in rituals for drawing and manifestation. In Crowley's magical system of Thelema, the inverted pentagram represents the descent of spirit into matter, making it applicable to many practical magical rites. In a rite to raise the dead, this would be quite literal. The idea of the inverted pentagram being a symbol of evil is traced back to the influential 19th century occultist Eliphas Levi. He was raised Catholic and had even studied for the priesthood. He is also credited with the creation of the iconic image of Baphomet. Both the use of the inverted pentagram in this depiction and subsequent worship of Baphomet was incorporated into the Church of Satan. I wonder what he would think of that. Sabrina and her fellow witches summon the guardians of an unnamed underworld gateway with Nos si vocarete, if you call us. It is standard ritual protocol to petition the gods of the realm, though they name none specifically. In the context of an inverted biblical cosmology, calling on one of the demonic princes of hell could be appropriate. They also make no offering, which is very unusual and would be detrimental to a real necromantic rite. In the rituals of the Greek magical papyri, to call dead souls for divination, It is normal to dig a pit and pour offerings directly into the earth. Milk, wine, and sometimes blood of a black goat or dog was standard. The dead, called upon, would also receive offerings, including fresh water, in their own pit. Appropriately, these rituals and offerings mirrored the Greek funeral rites. The barking of hounds signaled the arrival of the gatekeepers, echoing the myths of underworld deities and folklore about the approach of ghosts. Next, they opened the gateway by petitioning the guardians to open the door, Aperi Ianuam. Gusts of wind and the sound of chains signaled the opening of the portal. Lastly, a life for a life, Vita es Vita, and they make their human sacrifice over the pentagram. They wait 13 minutes, or the time it takes a witch's soul to leave its body, according to their world's lore, then bury the witch for resurrection in the cane patch.
The most glaring mistake is that Sabrina neglects to secure the body and prepare it for the soul's return. Tommy is resurrected back in the mines, buried under rubble, and has to dig his way out. Secondly, because both Tommy and Agatha, who sacrificed for him, are both kind of alive, the cosmic force of death is denied its required sacrifice. Tommy is zombified and soulless, and Agatha starts to decompose. There is no discount or deferred payment for necromancy. The lifeblood price for this magic must be paid in full.
Besides fighting demons and the thwarting minions of the Dark Lord, we see Sabrina and the gang fight what can be argued is the show's real villain, the patriarchy. Sabrina and her friends face gender issues, bullying, censorship, and limitations on free will and agency. Her sometimes problematic methods aside, this teenage witch is coming into her own power, and she rushes in to wield it, standing up to the unjust social and religious structures of her world. The Path of Night is the worst of the offenders, hiding misogynistic laws behind the lies of granting power and free will to its members. Despite going on about the false god, religion, and the mortal world, females in the Church of Night don't have much agency themselves. Men are still directing their spiritual and magical lives. Freedom and power is the driving desire for our uppity witch characters, but they are allowed only power as regulated and granted by their male deity. As Prudence says, the Dark Lord will never permit a witch to have both simply because he's a man. Satan is not just any man, but like his earthly representative, Father Blackwood, he is a man with unchecked power that disproportionately benefits from the existing power structure. Sabrina's previously discussed trial against the Dark Lord reflects on the hashtag MeToo movement, but she's not the only witch who suffers. We see Madam Satan groveling before Satan like an abused wife, Prudence gladly willing to be sacrificed, and Zelda's manipulation by Father Blackwood for sex. It is Sabrina's feminist ideals that make her the truest witch of the bunch. She consistently goes against the societal norms, breaks the rules, and questions all claims that limit her personal power and autonomy. Roz faces censorship multiple times in Baxter High. The most prominent example is Principal Hawthorne's denying access to banned books in the school's library. This restriction of information is made all the more poignant by the revelation of Roz's rapidly onsetting blindness. They later discover that there was a silent purge of questionable titles and react by protesting to the student body. Banned books is a battle still being waged across middle American schools. Fittingly, Jazz Sinclair, who plays Roz, is also an activist and was inspired as a child by one of the most popular literary witches from the also banned Harry Potter series. According to an MTV interview, Sinclair is a huge fan of Hermione Granger and has a lifelong obsession with the witch archetype. We are very happy to see a witch of color of Roz's caliber and are interested to see her character evolve as she deals with the cunning. A family tradition that is a curse and a blessing, this second sight is through the sacrifice of her own vision. As Roz faces this challenge, she also must come to terms with the ancestral trauma and knowledge that Sabrina's ancestors were the ones who laid the curse. Roz, like all the people who were colonized and enslaved, must find a way of healing the deep generational wounding and reclaim the wisdom and magic of her own bloodline.
The Mortal Men of Greendale reinforce patriarchal policies as well. Susie is bullied and assaulted by the high school's football players for being non-binary. Lachlan, the 17-year-old actor who plays Susie, was given the opportunity to talk to the writers about their own experience of exploring gender identity. Watson's input changed the pace of the character's story arc, taking the entire first season to slowly explore it and show a more accurate and intimate depiction of a genderqueer character. The character is accepted and supported by feminist allies without pressure to identify, and is further empowered by learning about a non-binary ancestor, Dorothea. The Kinkle clan men threaten their own family with punishments for challenging the societal norms. Harvey is verbally and physically abused by his father for not wanting to work in the local mines. This version of Harvey Kinkle was created for the Chilling Adventures, though it takes on a little of the doofus quality of his previous incarnations. He is a loyal, kind-hearted young artist that is outside the norms of maleness and the norms of his family. It was good to see a male character struggling with the negative effects of patriarchy included in this world. It shows us that patriarchy is even bad for men, which is something so rarely discussed. Now, while Sabrina curses and coerces the principal and the school bullies, she also enlists her mortal friends in some mundane civil action. Sabrina, Ross, and Susie set out to create a club to protect all the high school girls and provide a safe space where they can find sisterhood, solidarity, and support. They form WICCA, W-I-C-C-A. The Women's Intersectional Cultural and Creative Association. I'm not gonna lie, this hit me in the feels. I loved the creative acronym, and for many women, including yours truly, the Wiccan religion was an entrance into feminism and witchcraft. It also feels like a nod to witch, W-I-T-C-H, or the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, a New York City-based activist group formed in October 1968. These quote-unquote witches gathered to publicly curse the New York Stock Exchange. The presence of this small but theatrical group that embraced the witch archetype helped influence the rise of feminist witchcraft and Dianic Wiccan traditions in the 70s and 80s. And I'm glad to report that Witch was recently resurrected and has been a presence of political protests in major cities across the U.S.
The Chilling Adventures is unapologetically feminist and has even been called a much-needed, delicious revenge fantasy. It certainly causes a lot of polarized responses on the internet, despite the nuanced writing and thoughtful presentation of the issues. The magic ingredients of the show lie with an intersectional, diverse writing room and crew that is mostly women. Interestingly, the show's title has been generally abbreviated to CAOS, which can be pronounced as chaos. Chaos is precisely what those maintaining the patriarchal norms predict will result from true equality. We certainly hope the spell of chaos manifests quickly and with as much style. Death to the patriarchy!
On a lighter note, The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina is peppered with references to classic and popular horror throughout this first half of season one. To begin with, the show references its comic source material by pulling images right from the pages in the title sequence. This is paired with 50s and 60s period-appropriate horror movie music. For a detailed discussion on the show's source comic by Ogara Sakasa, check out The Witch Files episode number 16. The first episode alone is packed with many references. Its title, The October Country, is the name of a 1955 horror anthology by Ray Bradbury, which contains two short stories about a family of supernatural people with the surname Elliot. Sabrina parallels Michael Jackson's character from his music video Thriller, wearing red clothing like him and happily munching popcorn while she watches George Romero's Night of the Living Dead in a movie theater with her boyfriend Harvey and friends, while the audience around her is disturbed. The movie theater lobby has some cool movie posters including Them, the classic sci-fi giant ant movie from 1954, Freaks, a pre-code horror movie from 1932, and Taste of the Blood of Dracula from 1970. Harvey, Sabrina's boyfriend, quotes the famous line from Romero's Night of the Living Dead on their way home. They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Teacher Mary Wardwell states that she will take a young woman, Madam Satan in disguise, to Dr. Saperstein in the morning. Dr. Saperstein was the Satanist OBGYN from the horror movie classic Rosemary's Baby.
Serb's bookstore, where Sabrina and her friends hang out and where Anne Hilda later works, has connections to showrunner Ogara Sakasa. Roberto wrote a play called Dr. Cerebus about a teen who is obsessed with the host of Saturday night horror movie TV show Dr. Cerebus. Cerebus is also the three-headed dog in Greek mythology who guards the gates of the underworld.
Sabrina crushes a bat with a book, which is a reference to the horror movie Suspiria, when protagonist Susie kills a bat with a stool. Sabrina later buries the dead bat in their pet cemetery near a sundial, which is a reference to the horror movie Pet Sematary.
The rest of the episodes of the show also have plenty of cool horror nuggets in them. When Principal Hawthorne calls Sabrina and her friends to his office, Ross says, "He's back," which of course is a play on the famous Poltergeist movie line.
Edward Spellman's Acheron configuration box reminds one of the puzzle box from Hellraiser called the Lament Configuration. Its creator, Clive Barker, has contributed over 150 of his original paintings to the show that you will see adorning the walls of the Academy and other sets of the show.
The episode, Dreams in a Witch House, takes its title from an H.P. Lovecraft story and is reminiscent of the Buffy episode, Restless, and the Doctor Who episode, Amy's Choice. In another episode, Harvey Kinkle lies in a bed wearing headphones and a white football jersey with the number 10 on it, which is in homage to Johnny Depp's character, Glenn, in the movie Nightmare on Elm Street. And of course, the episode An Exorcism in Greendale is a clear homage to the horror classic The Exorcist.
In the holiday special, Sabrina tries to conjure her mother, Diana, through a seance in which she appears in her wedding dress. As per Ogara Sakasa, this is a nod to the seance scene from the cult classic movie Beetlejuice. The episode also has a Krampus-like character called Mr. Bartle, and other creatures from the Norse and Germanic folklore, such as Gryla and the Yule Lads. The special also pays homage to the classic Charles Dickens book, A Christmas Carol, with Sabrina saying, "Satan, bless us, everyone," which is a reversal of Tiny Tim's famous quote, "God bless us, everyone." Ambrose reads from A Christmas Carol, and three demons come out of the Greendale Mine, which evokes the three ghosts that visit Ebenezer Scrooge during the novel. Zelda's peekaboo scene with Letitia is a reference to the recent popular horror movie, The Witch. Check out our episode number 3 on The Witch for a full breakdown.
Ambrose and Harvey discuss their love for comics in another scene, all of which are visionary occult authors near and dear to our hearts. We explore Alan Moore's comic Promethea in Witch Files episode 11.
We could go on forever about the many other obvious and hidden horror nuggets in the show, but we'll leave that for you guys to discover.
So, as fans of both horror and comics, The Chilling Adventures was a deliciously dark good time. We eagerly await seasons to come to see how fierce the characters and Sabrina's powers become. For its rich world lore, solid grasp on witchcraft, and rebel spirit, we give The Chilling Adventures 6 toads out of 7. For us, one of the things we enjoy the most was the show's use of pieces of witchcraft folklore in crafting its magical universe. It was really fun digging in and discovering all the nuggets of real-world lore, which showed the writer's personal knowledge and careful research of witchcraft.
The second element of the show that we enjoyed was the low level of instant magic by hand or gesture, which was in the magical system. For the most part, the magical practitioners were shown putting in the time and work that real-world magic requires. Was it all realistic? Of course not. We don't think any show can be 100% realistic. But we appreciated the effort made to try to depict some of the preparation and work involved in magical workings.
The third element we really liked about the show was that it maintained the teeth and subversive nature of witchcraft, while also showing the possible consequences of it as well. Witchcraft has always resided firmly in territory that is challenging, confronting, and subversive. Mundane and uplifting, as well as deeply personal, dark, ugly, messy, and dangerous. We appreciated the love, warmth, and caring of Hilda's magic on behalf of Sabrina, but we also appreciated the deep discomfort of having to watch some of the difficult elements of necromantic magic.
In terms of negatives, our biggest complaint was the lack of diversity in the types of witchcraft depicted. We understand that the dominant focus of the show is the Church of Night and its left-handed path, but would have liked to see other forms of witchcraft that could coexist alongside it, which could both challenge and balance the witch's world. We feel there was a missed opportunity for the show to have expanded and fleshed out Roz's family lineage of the cunning by killing off her grandmother Ruth before she could have served as elder, mentor, and teacher for Roz on her path. The show could have embraced a path of witchcraft based on traditional African-American and African diaspora spirituality and magic. It could have given the show an interesting alternative point of view and pathway from the dominant white Western European perspective.
So that's a wrap, and thank you for once again joining us on another episode of The Witch Files. For more information about today's review, check out the show notes on our website, thewitchfiles.blogspot.com, and that's witch with a Y. Also included in the notes for each episode is a YouTube playlist full of related goodies. And of course, we would love to hear from you. Drop us a line at thewitchfiles@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where we are at The Witch Files. Let us know how we're doing, or if there's something you're dying for us to review. And of course, if you like what you're hearing, spread the word with rating or reviewing the show on iTunes. It really helps others find the show.
All critical reviews featured on The Witch Files are for entertainment purposes only.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are the reviews of those sole individuals expressing them and do not reflect the views of the artist and/or artistic property being viewed.
In addition, The Witch Files does not receive any compensation or endorsements in exchange for their reviews.
All company names mentioned within the podcast are trademarks or registered trademarks of their respective holders.
Use of any trademarks or other names in the program does not constitute or imply any affiliation with or endorsement by them in any manner whatsoever.
Grand Canyon University, a Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering over 200 engaging programs online. GCU invests in high demand areas such as nursing, teaching, and the sciences. Students engage with faculty who become partners in your success. GCU's online students received over $100 million in scholarships in 2020. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you qualify for.
Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.